From the land-grant university in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the third day of August 2026. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Jerry Golke. He's from the Golke Group. We'll hear a report on renewable volume obligations and how they're driving crush capacity to increase in the United States. And we'll have an update on what ADM's plans are for crush capacity across the U.S. And then, as we wrap up our time together, we'll turn our attention to the weather forecast. Mark Russo will be here. He's with Everstream Analytics on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Medium. It is public radio for the farming world online on demand at willag.org. That's willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Jerry Golke of the Golke Group now joins us to take a look at the marketplace. Jerry, it's been a while. Thank you so much for joining us today on the program. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
We have an update in the marketplace. Corn up 8 cents. Let's start there. I don't know if this was a surprise to you or if it is expected.
Well, I expected it with tongue in cheek, I guess. Always, nobody's ever right 100% of the time. But I recognize the odds and how the markets perform. And you know, technically, it went back to an area where it should have turned around. And we have some fundamental things happening to this markets, corn and soybeans in particular, and maybe even wheat globally. But that gave indications that, first of all, you know, we, as I mentioned earlier to you in other emails, why we started lifting hedges about June 15th and then completed them on June 30th because we had buy signals and we have a proprietary stuff that I've used since 1982. I hate to mention it that long, but and it works. If nothing else, it keeps a person out of trouble when it's if you're brain dead and you don't know what to do, you can get yourself in trouble by making up an excuse to do buy or sell or whatever, or hold or hedge or sell something. And that told us that the risk was on the upside, not the downside. And that's been a longstanding focus that I've had since August of 2024, when we made lows back then. You know, that was a capitulation by the farmers back then. And we've been, although in the media, the news about how bad agriculture is, you know, we've been in an uptrend ever since, corn and beans both. So this was the point where if you're ever going to take a chance, it's this was it to accept risk. There's a point where you pass off risk by hedging. So you pass off hedge risk to somebody else who thinks it's going to go a lot higher, and you like the price, or you have an outlook mechanism that tells you to do that, which I do. And then, or there's a point where you accept risk. It says, you know, at these levels, I'll accept the risk because I think I know my risk. And that would be, sometimes it's the close below last week's lows. Just like this week, if we turn out to have some positive news in the ratings and also in the WASDE, then you'd have to look back at the reversals today, which is a key reversal up in corn, almost in beans, and in bean oil. And now you can look at it and say, all right, if this is true and we're going to head higher right into fall and through harvest and right into December and in the Q1 of 2027, what should happen and how high you're going to go, but what should not happen? You should not take out today's lows if that happens, and you have to take it day by day. So the market tells you, analyzes hundreds of fundamentals every day, and depicts on the price changes your opinion, my opinion, and maybe a half a million other people in the world, and votes, and at the close that decides who won or lost. And that's a simplistic view of the futures market, but it's the best risk management tool we have.
So when you think about the market and the things that may or may not happen in the future, what is it that you watch? Is it just really the charts at this point? So, for instance, if the lows get taken out, then you say, well, I've got another 60 cents down or 70 or whatever target you have for soybeans I'm talking about, or for corn, either one. What kinds of things do you think about more broadly in the marketplace that helps you to drive the marketplace in a direction?
Well, of course, fundamentals are the main driver, but the smart money that's betting millions of dollars on the market and not a few hundred or thousands of dollars a farmer might, they have a tendency to be able to foresee things much better than I do, or the large spec or the funds and so forth. They've got a lot of money at risk, and how they act, and it's money flow, it's cash flow, where it's going to and where it's not. And maybe it's sometimes you'll watch a market go straight up and it starts to lose momentum. It's kind of like a car going up a hill and it finally runs out of gas, and you just hope you get to the top before you have to start backing down the hill. And you get a sense for it, and then also you develop a program, perhaps maybe a computerized situation that gives you a hint, keeps you out of trouble. Usually the tops are made when they're most bullish. And if you recall the May 13th high, and I remember it because that's my birthday, and I look forward, it happened 2 years ago, didn't happen last year. We made the highs in February 21st, and the media that I watch and listen to on the radio sometimes was all saying, well, we're going to make the highs again this year in February. They blew right through it and went on up to the conventional May 13th, which just happened to be the time frame when the fact sheet was released on the hope that we were going to make a deal with China. And I wrote on DTN that deal wasn't any better than phase one of Trump, or it wasn't worth the paper it was written on. There are outs in it, and there are ways that China didn't have to perform for various reasons. But it was a framework, and it disappointed the large spec and a lot of people. I know there were some brokers, as I understood, actually got out of their hedges, went long once that meeting was, and then when they found out the facts of it, down the wind. And then we got all this talk about, well, China will never buy, and they wouldn't buy the 9 million, they won't buy 12, and they won't buy 25 million, and they've done nothing but keep their word, so to speak, and nothing more than a verbal contract. And it's a letter of intent, so to speak, but the fact sheet gives some openings. They're going to meet in September to decide, how did you do? You know, I'm Trump. Am I happy with you, or am I not happy with you? And the incentive for Trump, for China to buy beans at $1, $1.50 more per bushel than what they can buy them from Brazil, to me, is the art of the deal. You buy beans from Jerry, and I don't care if you dump them in the Michigan, Lake Michigan, just get them out of my country. And for that, I'll be nice to you from a tariff standpoint. So you're going to invest $750 million, maybe $1 billion in more expense in buying beans from Jerry and his friends. And you're probably going to get a 10-to-1 reward back because they need that tariff because their economy is threatening. And it makes perfect sense. And if you've ever bought land, you know, and made a deal on without a broker, we'll say from a landowner, you make a deal where you walk away from the table and you're both happy. And you both feel like you won something. And you can go home and feel like you served your country, or you served your party, or served your personal ego well. And that's how I viewed it. And the market usually seems to be a lot smarter than me. It starts to give me signals that in advance of something happening. And I never look at how high they'll say, well, how high do you think this is going to go, Jerry? And if you're so doggone bullish, why aren't you long grain? Well, I'm long in the field, long in the bin, or whatever. But I don't know how high it's going to go, but I trust in the same philosophy that I have when picking the low. The tops are a lot harder. All of a sudden, one day, it's over, and you just hope that you get the signal ahead of time, and you get the flip the coupon on top. And it's not that difficult to understand or to calculate, but trust me, it's difficult to do if you're a producer and somebody. And I tell myself, you just got done with harvest, Jerry, and there's no future left in it. Sell all your grain. That's not easy. I've been there, done that, and you have to have a lot of confidence.
Hey, thank you much. I really appreciate it. Look forward to talking with you again soon.
Yep, feel free to call anytime.
Will do. Jerry Gaulke is with the Gaulke Group. Up next, more about EPA and the RVO, the Environmental Protection Agency's new renewable fuel standard volumes are giving the biodiesel industry a significant boost. As you'll hear from Stephanie Hoff, the agency raised biomass-based diesel obligations to levels the industry says more accurately reflect production capacity.
Clean Fuels Alliance America says the higher volumes are already helping idle plants restart, encouraging new investment and creating stronger demand throughout the agricultural economy. Paul Winters, the director of public affairs, explains.
The volume that everyone agreed on was 5.25 billion gallons. That's the production volume that everyone settled on. Some people were higher, some people were lower, but we all sort of agreed on 5.25 as the minimum volume that could be produced. For the 2025 RFS volumes, EPA had set 3.35 billion gallons as the volume. That had a pretty devastating effect on our industry, combined with uncertainty over tax credits. Essentially, a lot of small producers were forced to idle production.
The new rule raises biomass-based diesel volumes to about 5.4 billion gallons. Winters says the impact is already being felt across the industry.
Particularly for smaller producers, they were a little more nimble in responding. We saw some idled plants come back into production. We saw other small producers just ramping up to the highest volume they could manage and run at full out. They've been doing so for several months now. So overall, the biodiesel industry is operating at 86% of the capacity that is estimated to be operable. It's not the highest operating capacity we've ever achieved, but it's certainly up there where EPA envisioned it should be.
Beyond biodiesel production, Winters says the increased volumes are driving investment farther up the supply chain, creating new opportunities for soybean growers and processors.
I mean, the first impact you're seeing is in the soybean processing industry. The oilseed processors have invested more than $6 billion over the past 4 or 5 years to expand their capacity by a third. The oilseed processing industry for a long time had running capacity to crush about 2 billion bushels of soybeans every single year. The United States was up planting and harvesting more than 4 billion bushels of soybeans every year. And then there were disruptions in international markets. This year, the oilseed processing industry in the United States is scheduled to process about 2.6 billion bushels, and it will even go higher next year, 2.75 billion bushels.
Those investments are also translating into jobs and renewed economic activity in rural communities.
We actually sent a letter to President Trump in mid-June highlighting several of those stories. We highlighted a plant in Iowa, in Wall Lake, Iowa, that had shut down in 2025 and had not laid off all of its employees, but was definitely reducing its workforce. That plant is up operating at full capacity now and is rehiring all those employees.
Winters says the benefits extend well beyond biodiesel plants, supporting businesses and industries throughout rural America.
It's not just the Midwest. The benefits are flowing through to other industries like railroads. They're opening up new markets and new avenues. And these were things that EPA certainly was aware were possible as outflows from the higher volumes. They wrote these scenarios into the rule itself and said, this is one of our goals, is to promote this type of economic activity. We are definitely gathering all these stories. We're definitely sharing them with EPA to show that what they did with this year's rule is paying off in the ways that we all knew were possible.
Paul Winters is the Director of Public Affairs and Federal Communications with Clean Fuels Alliance America, speaking to the industry-wide advantage of the EPA's decision to increase renewable volume obligations. I'm Stephanie Hoff reporting.
Our thanks to Stephanie Hoff and the National Association of Farm Broadcasting for that report, the NAFB. Now, for something a bit local on this same topic, ADM has announced a strategic series of investments. They're aimed at expanding its North American oilseed crush capacity to meet the rising demands for renewable diesel fuel and vegetable oils, driven largely by the biofuels policy you just heard about. Now, the initiative relies on making targeted infrastructure and throughput enhancements to existing operations, says ADM. Rather than constructing entirely new plants, these localized facility upgrades will collectively unlock, it says, about 700,000 metric tons of additional annual crush capacity across the United States, generating new demand for over 25 million bushels of crops from American agricultural producers annually. The initial expansion efforts will focus on four specific U.S. production facilities. They're located in Frankfort, Indiana, Deerfield, Missouri, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Spiritwood, North Dakota. Planned enhancements range from storage and equipment upgrades to comprehensive debottlenecking and operational optimization, with projected completion dates scheduled between mid-2028 and early 2029. Let's take a look at the weather forecast now. We're joined by Mark Russo. He is at Everstream Analytics on this Monday afternoon. Hi, Mark. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin here in the United States. Tell me about this rainfall over the weekend. How widespread really was it, and how much do you think it helped crops out?
Well, Todd, it was pretty widespread across the Midwest. By our calculation, we got around two-thirds of the Midwest corn acreage picked and soybean acreage picked up meaningful rainfall and helped to contract some of the previous dry pockets that were around. For that third of the belt that did miss out, that did include some dry pockets, namely in Northwest Iowa and far southeast South Dakota, as well as some parts of North Dakota as well. So as we've now moved fully into August, at least those are the dry pockets that will, you know, still need some rainfall here. But again, you're talking about pockets versus the rest of the Corn Belt that is in really good shape here, and as we'll talk about here in a bit, there's more rain coming up.
Well, tell me about that.
Sure. Following these bigger rains over the weekend, we are going to see a continuation of opportunities here coming up over the next few weeks. And in general, when you add up the next 2 weeks, rainfall looks to register close to normal. So that is going to maintain or further improve soil moisture across much of the Midwest corn and soybean belt. And even for those dry pockets in Northwest Iowa and Eastern North Dakota, they have good opportunities to improve here. So we'd be pretty surprised if we get to the middle part of August and we're still actually talking about even these pockets of dryness. I guess you can't rule out a very small scale area here totally missing out, but all in all, it's looking really good here to further improve things as we move through these first 2 weeks of August.
Temperatures generally normal?
Yes. We're kind of done with the more significant heat here of late. All of the heat is out across the western half of the country. It's going to be a little warm up here over the weekend and next week, especially in the western part of the Midwest, but not seeing any kind of big time heat of temperatures climbing above 95 Fahrenheit or anything like that in the core of the Midwest. So no significant heat issues are expected.
Is it the heat in the western part of the United States that drives the rainfall and the cooler temperatures or normal temperatures across the Midwest?
Yeah, that's certainly a part of it with that heat associated with the ridging of high pressure. And that's where the ridge looks to be, you know, primarily here over those over the next couple of weeks. At times, there will be a little kind of, you know, brief surge of ridging, or the ridge access moves into the Midwest, but no sign of that moving fully over the Midwest over the next couple of weeks. And with the pattern, yeah, that keeps temperatures more seasonal, and also on the periphery of the ridge, more rain systems coming through.
Let's return to that ridge in just a moment, but could you focus now on Western Europe?
Yes, especially Western Europe. That has been the most problematic area this growing season. In fact, across the entire Northern Hemisphere, it's France that has seen the most extreme heat and dryness. France is Europe's largest corn producing country. It's also a huge dairy producing area as well as other, you know, kind of summer crops and other types of livestock there focused in France. And overall, again, that's been where the epicenter of most extreme conditions have been. But even Eastern Europe has trended hotter and drier of late. And so we're now seeing, you know, a drop in conditions and lowering of yield potential there. But again, Western Europe, it's essentially a crop disaster. It's too late for any meaningful recovery here now that we're in August. And even the pattern over the next few weeks, it's still hot and dry across much of Europe, and there's just no sign of any pattern change that would begin to improve rainfall.
Any new or developing issues that we should be watching?
Yeah, we're closely watching Southeast Asia. Again, areas such as like Indonesia and Malaysia tend to have a higher risk during El Nino events. And we've certainly started to see that here since around July the 1st with Kalimantan, Indonesia. That is their largest palm-producing area, that has trended much drier. In fact, this past July was one of the driest Julys in the past 20 years across that region and on the island of Borneo. And coming up here over the next few weeks, not only will Kalimantan, Indonesia be drier than normal, but that looks to also begin expanding across more of Indonesia and Malaysia. So with the dryness expanding here, the timing of it, and with the ongoing El Nino, that continues to be an area of increasing concern.
Tell me about El Nino. Still super El Nino? Yeah,
absolutely. We're basically at super El Nino levels right now. Again, that's kind of technically defined as when water temperatures in that Nino 3.4 area achieve plus 2 Celsius anomaly status. Now, there's been kind of an upgrade in some of the sea surface temperature data sets here of late. And whether you look at those updated indices or some of the legacy indices, again, we're basically at these super El Nino levels. And El Nino is going to continue to strengthen. And we do feel that it, you know, most likely here, this is going to be the strongest El Nino ever recorded. So the greatest anomalies in that 3.4 and ultimately, you know, having a large range of impacts here in weather patterns around the world.
And now come back to the United States. There had been some thoughts that the fall could be wet. Are you one of those that are thinking that might be the case?
Yes, we do feel that as we move into fall, that the risk will be increasing for above normal rainfall, especially in and around the Midwest. And the time frame to watch is October. That has the strongest relationship between El Nino conditions in the Pacific Ocean and a wetter bias in the pattern across the Midwest. It's not as much September, but October. So that's going to be a time frame to watch closely here. In terms of potential, you know, wetness that, you know, could start to hinder harvest activity.
Thank you much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Todd.
Mm-hmm. That's Mark Russo. He is with Everstream Analytics. Joined us on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.